The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 1.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to the first episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Why did I launch this podcast? Well, I took Gandhi's advice. Other people weren't doing what I wanted, and so I'm going to be the podcast that I want to see in the world. What I am going to be doing is having conversations with various authors and other thinkers. And what I'm going to try to do for those particular episodes is get into areas where, especially if there are people that make the circuit and you've heard them on other podcasts, I want to ask questions and get into topics that don't normally come up. Okay, so that's one objective of this podcast. And it's going to cover a gamut of issues. It's not just going to be economics or libertarianism. I'm also going to just get into people who are scientists and mathematicians, perhaps, and also areas of Christian doctrine as well will come into play. The other thing, too, though, is if there's some hot topic of the day that I normally would just write a blog post about, I may also come here and give an audio version of my thoughts on the issue. So this Bob Murphy Show podcast is going to be a mixture of me just speaking to you folks, talking about economic issues primarily, and also conversations with people that I think you will find interesting. Now, a word about the intro that you just heard. I, of course, hired a voice actor to do that, and I want to be clear, he's not literally doing a Liam Neeson impression. All right, even though I told the guy, I obviously got it, someone who had an Irish accent, and I said I wanted to be in the ballpark of Liam Neeson. And there's two reasons that. Because number one, I thought perhaps years down the road, it would get old if the guy was literally trying to sound like Liam Neeson. But also, secondly, if anyone's going to be doing a Liam Neeson impression on the Bob Murphy Show, it's going to be me. And with that intro, let me now introduce to you folks our first guest. He is a man. He hasn't studied money, but what he has studied is a particular set of skills. Skills acquired over a long career for online marketing. If you unsubscribe from Tom Woods' email list, he will not pursue you. Thanks, folks. I'll be here for the rest of the podcast. Tom Woods is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and he's the host of The Tom Woods Show. He holds a bachelor's degree in history from Harvard and his master's and PhD from Columbia University. Tom's the author of 12 books, most recently Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And I believe these are the actual paper books. He also has all sorts of ebooks that we'll get into in the course of our conversation. Of course, I'm sure many of you know that Tom and I co-host the popular podcast Contra Krugman, which is at ContraKrugman.com, where every week we typically pick apart the latest column from Paul Krugman. And now, folks, to my conversation with Tom Woods. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the first episode of The Bob Murphy Show.
This is really something else, Bob. I'm thrilled to be the first guest.
And I want to say that partly, I mean, obviously you're an interesting guest and my crowd, my fans would have naturally liked someone like you since basically it's the same crowd. But I also wanted to have you on just so people know we're not breaking up. It's not that we had a fight and I went and stormed off. It's just, you know, we have some creative differences and I need the freedom to do the podcast the way I want to do it.
It's like your favorite band. They're just going off to do some solo projects, but yet they're still keeping the band going.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's very rare to see that. Usually the solo projects mean, uh-oh.
Yeah.
See you later. But yeah. No. The solo projects will make the group project all the stronger.
It'll probably be like when Daryl Hall left and then he realized, and he came back with Oates. You know, it'll be like that.
Yeah, so. There you go. But this would be more like he kept Hall and Oates going the whole time.
Exactly. All right, so the other thing, just to clarify for people, what I want to do here is, since I'm sure most of the listeners know the standard thing you would do, Tom, if you were the guest on some other established podcast, I want to talk here with you about things that don't often come up.
And so I'm going to go way back. I want to go back to your younger days. Some people may not realize this, but you actually were a super math geek, such that you participated in competitions. Am I right? Am I warm?
Yeah, in high school, I was the captain of the math team. Mm.
And so,
I was the most popular kid in school.
Well, I'm sure you were the prom king, and
yeah, yeah, right, yeah, I was the prom king, indeed.
Yeah, it's like you're the king of the airport with this thing. I think some of us, you know, we sort of detect, you know, you're, how can I put it? You sometimes are very pugilistic, as it were, and I wonder sometimes, you know, did you have a rough childhood? Were you sometimes defensive?
Well, you know, it's funny when you look at me on social media, and by social media in this case, I really mean Twitter. On Facebook, I'm not particularly combative, and that's partly because I don't think the format lends itself quite as much to that. Although obviously people have Facebook fights all the time, but with Twitter, I don't know. It's so drive-by, the whole format. So it's a lot easier to get stuck into that. But I will say something that I think I may have said in a recent interview with somebody else, or maybe even one of my own episodes, or maybe, you know what? I actually think I wrote this as an email to one of my two email lists. I think it's the one you're not on, actually, where I talked
well,
about...
Well, that's why it's new to me, yeah.
Yeah, well, right, but I mean, it's not that many people. And I was very, very open about this. And I said that when I was a kid, I mean, I was only joking about high school, because in high school, things actually worked out really well for me. But in junior high, they didn't. I had gone to this elementary school that was pretty nice, and I liked the kids, and I had my friends. But then when we all went to junior high, that's where maybe half a dozen local elementary schools were sending kids all at once. So sixth grade was like a whole new process of meeting a whole bunch more people. And at that point, I was kind of at my most awkward. And I just did not connect with these kids on any level whatsoever. And I mean, look, I know I was only 11, but I was interested in politics and stuff like that, even at that age. And that's not allowed. That did not go over. So it was just one thing after another. I found myself on the receiving end of quite a bit of abuse for several years. And it was pretty terrible. And I finally climbed out of it by the time I got to sophomore year of high school. But it was pretty awful. And it really did, I think, leave a mark on me, in that it made me kind of skeptical about my ability to make friends. I mean, it was kind of like when I had a really bad bout of insomnia 20 years ago. I've never forgotten it. It was so bad. It was like almost a week. I could not sleep at all. And when you go that long without sleeping, when you get in bed, you forget what you're supposed to do. You say, how did I used to do this? Did I just close my eyes and wait? Or I just couldn't remember how I did it. And so it was the same kind of doubt that I was plagued with, that maybe I'm not good at this, or maybe when people say they're my friend, I can't really be sure they are. Or if they invite me to lunch, is it because they feel like they had to invite me because I was standing there? Do they really want me there? And I just became, to an unreasonable degree, plagued by doubt about myself. And so there have been times when I believe, maybe I'm psychoanalyzing myself too much, but I believe that some of that is coming out in people attacking me. I feel like it's kind of like in those old days when I was basically just a nice kid that nobody really bothered to get to know. And I kind of feel like there's a bit of that happening again, but except now I have confidence and I do have people who are friends. And I do have people who are followers. And this makes me feel like, and again, it's not like a conscious thing, but I think I'm hitting back because I feel like it's that kid from junior high, except now, you know, he's been working out and he's not going to be intimidated anymore. And so now I push back and I hit back. So I think there is a bit of that. I mean, I know how childish and juvenile that sounds, but frankly, I think there's a lot of it that's at the root of that. And then on the other hand, I do just have fun doing it because sometimes I get a good zinger in and I feel like that's kind of funny and entertaining for everybody. But frankly, I do think there is something deeper at the root of it. And I don't know if that's what you were fishing for,
yeah.
But I think that's more than you bargained for when you asked me the question.
I think we're uncovering a lot today. We're making a lot of progress in this session. And
this Bob Murphy show is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It's so I like, just how specific do you mean? Like in eighth grade, did the bully, you know, make you sign a fascism pledge? Or
never rose to quite that level, of course.
I was going to say, if they like took your lunch money, you're like, that's why I'm against redistribution. I just, you know, these...
No, I was just, you know, not ever part of any real group. Mm-hmm. And just nasty things and being mocked. And, oh, I made a mistake once seventh grade, and the teacher was talking about a made-for-TV movie that you might remember, Bob, The Day After with Jason Robards. And it was about, the idea was there had been a nuclear war.
Yeah.
And here's what life looked like afterward. And I was immensely curious about this. My parents wouldn't let me watch it because they thought I would have nightmares about it. But that was kind of why I wanted to watch it. I wanted to be scared to death. Yeah. Did they not understand?
And plus, you weren't sleeping anyway, so.
That's exactly. So what's the big problem? But I made some comment about Ronald Reagan and nuclear war. And I just, again, you're not supposed to care. Apparently, you're not even supposed to care about nuclear war, like the end of the world as we know it. I mean, it really was. And by the way, I was interested in sports. So it wasn't that. I did have an interest in sports. But it was – I mean, even that, even having an opinion on that made me just a pariah. It just seemed so weird to me. All right, look, you have different interests from me. Why should that matter? But that was not the way people looked at it at the time.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I guess since we're sharing here, I wasn't bullied per se. But yeah, when I was younger, I was Bob the Brain. One time I passed gas and I was Bob the Slob briefly, but that was, you know how kids are. They come up with nicknames.
Yeah.
So I would have been able to handle Trump in the primaries because I'm familiar with that technique.
Yeah. See, in my case, it was, they would, first of all, there are worse things to be called, I suppose, than a brain. But it's, as I say, it's not really the path to popularity. But eventually what happened was by the 10th grade, people suddenly realized, wait a minute, this guy is so funny. We actually never stopped to realize how funny the guy was. Now, see, by my standard, I mean, I'm not Bob Murphy funny. You know, we all know that. Everybody who listens to Contra Krugman knows that. But my school had lower standards for what was considered funny than whatever the Murphy school was. And it was enough that by the 10th grade, people kind of, hey, that guy's kind of okay. And by the time I left, I didn't want to leave. I thought, how could college possibly be better than this? So I somehow made it work. I just clawed my way back. And what could have happened, I could have just sat around feeling sorry for myself. Oh, or just saying, these are all terrible people and there's no point in even bothering to try to get to know any of them. But that wouldn't have been helpful for me in any way. It would have just kept me in a pretty, what they call a dark place these days. Mm-hmm. So I just fought back against it and it ended up kind of being okay.
So do you feel like if you could get to 100,000 Twitter followers, you'd be able to move on?
Well, the funny thing is, in terms of moving on, this is going to sound embarrassingly recent, but I went to my 25-year high school reunion 3 years ago. That would have been 2015. Now, it wasn't like I was constantly stewing about junior high at that point, but it still did bother me. I had never really fully gotten over it. But we went to that reunion, and I thought to myself, I can see any of my really good friends anytime. I was going to be in town for several days. I'm going into this thing and I'm going to seek out people I never really connected with or even people who gave me a hard time before. And I'm just going to try and just talk like adults. And it turned out that everybody was normal. You know, they'd all gone through the awkward phase where they were covering their insecurities by making fun of the other kid. That was all gone. And what instead I found were people saying to me, hey, we heard you're doing really well. Everybody's really proud of you. I thought, wait a minute, that's not what I was expecting to hear, you know, right? So I spent the whole night just kind of not quite burying hatchets, but more or less that kind of thing. In fact, one of the kids, his daughter had cancer. And I just could not imagine with five daughters of my own what that would be like. So I sought him out, actually, and he was probably one of the worst ones to me. And I just said, I heard what happened to your daughter, and that's just terrible. I'm sorry. Nobody should have to go through that. We had this great conversation. Then I went over and I talked to somebody who had also been in my kind of boat all those years. And I said, yeah, I just talked to so-and-so, and, you know, his daughter had cancer. And his response was, yeah, serves him right. I said, whoa, man, that's pretty.
Oh, wow. So he was that, yeah. This other guy was that much of a jerk
exactly.
In high school that was the reaction.
That was the reaction. And I thought to myself, if I hadn't, thank God that's not me. You know, that I thank God I hadn't stayed at that point where I hated the world so much that I could give that kind of answer. So I was kind of getting a glimpse that this is the guy I could have turned out to be if I hadn't made a conscious effort to avoid that path.
Well, I feel like we need to say something to the younger crowds because we do have a lot of young people listening. I'm sure 98% of them are male. And seriously, guys, this is something where I remember because I had filed away. It wasn't as bad for me, Tom, as it sounds like it was for you. But yeah, I definitely went through. Like I sort of put up a big, armor to get through junior high and the early years of high school. And I was like you that by junior, senior year of high school, I started to say, actually, this isn't so bad. But then later, somebody was asking me and I was thinking back, like I had been on a soccer team and somebody was like, what about the kids in that team? And my initial reaction was like, oh yeah, they were all a bunch of jerks. And I was like, well, this one kid was all right. Well, this kid was all right. And I went through in my head and literally every single kid in the team, I went through and just thought of him individually and was like, no, he never did anything bad to me. And I realized, and in high school too, I was thinking about it more carefully. And what had happened was in freshman year, I was trying to walk over and join this group of kids. And one guy in the group said, get out of here, Bob. We don't want nerds. And I, sort of cowered and walked away and sort of gruffly, well, I don't want to hang out with you guys anyway, And I realized later that this guy, I thought about it, he had been really unpopular earlier and now was sort of rising. And so he had to show everybody that he was now above me. Whereas like the actual cool kids that he was trying to join, I'm sure they weren't agreeing with his statement to me, but it's not like as I'm walking away, they're going to say, no, Bob, come on and hang out with us. You know what I mean? Like that just doesn't happen. So, and the last thing too, that your story reminded me, when I went to my high school reunion, there was a similar thing where I was bouncing around different groups and I was talking to this group of girls who had been like, sort of like, they weren't like the popular girls, but they also weren't picked on. They were just sort of like, middle of the road. And there was a group of like the cool guys who were over, in the corner. And they started gossiping about those guys and like some of the statements from this one girl about this one guy in particular and how jerky what. And I had to tell her, I said, whoa, no, like I used to briefly hang out with those guys playing soccer and said, no, he's not like that at all. I could see his friends. Some of his friends are, but he's not. So anyway, I'm saying to the listeners, just because one guy at the table says something, don't assume everyone sitting next to him endorses the statement that's probably not the case. And so don't think as a collectivist. I guess that's a good lesson in general, both in politics and in navigating high school.
That principle extends also to when you're in class and students are making comments related to the subject matter, particularly in college where students sometimes feel like they need to show off or make sure the professor knows how smart they are. And what you sometimes do is you attribute to one kid what everybody says. In other words, you walk out of there with this impression that the class has a lot of knowledge and you think, therefore, each kid has all that knowledge. And you have to understand, each kid had one thing to say, but it can sometimes get bundled into your head that, geez, that class just knows so much more than I do. Maybe collectively. And frankly, in a lot of colleges, even collectively, they're not going to have the knowledge that you have. But there are, I have heard people, that's not ever a problem I really felt like I was having, but I've heard people say that when they hear a lot of participation in class, it intimidates them because they think that each brain had all that knowledge in it instead of stopping and saying, well, really, this kid only said that one thing and that kid didn't say anything and whatever. So treat people like individuals, see? It serves you well.
Imagine that, yeah. And also, just as a comment on that, it took me a while to realize that people bluff. So, like, I know when I went to NYU as a grad student in the beginning, I mean, I was used to, like, an undergrad, I would go to classes if the class interested me just because I was a nerd and I wanted to hear. But, like, all I had to really do was study the night before the exam and I was going to get an A. And then I went to grad school and I was way out of my league at first. There were kids there, or they weren't kids. They were young adults who already had master's degrees and such. And, I went right from undergrad. And in the first year, I thought I was going to fail out, partly because, I wasn't scoring well on the midterms and stuff, but which was totally new to me. But also in class, the other students would be yelling out answers to fixed point theorems and stuff I'd never heard of. And I realized later, though, that they were kind of bluffing. Like they didn't understand the stuff they were talking about. Like, in other words, if I was going to say something in class, I really knew what I was talking about. And mostly I was just kept my mouth shut that first year because I didn't know what was going on. And the other people were all yelling out stuff. And so, I thought, geez, I'm the stupidest kid in the class. And I realized later it was a combination of, they've just seen this before because they took a master's class, but also other people aren't afraid to just yell stuff out with confidence. That was the thing. When I realized later, some people had, quote, taught me stuff like how to do certain homework problems with confidence, and they actually didn't know what they were talking about. And I was just amazed, like, why would you try to teach me something and you don't know what you're doing?
And the bluffing, of course, has gotten even worse with social media, where people will give the impression that they know all the literature on some subject. That's because they know they've got Google and they can always skim it if they're ever called on it.
Yeah. Well, Did you ever see Mises one time had an offhand remark about them? It was funny. You imagine, you know, Mises sort of grumbling. He was, I forget what it was. It might've been something where he was younger. You know how he was feistier when he was younger? And he wrote something about like, professors or whatever, if they're out giving a public lecture on like the merits of socialism and somebody raises an objection, can say, oh, well, so-and-so in 1932 answered that. And then they move on with their talk and the common man is convinced. But what they don't know is that so-and-so in 1932 completely failed to see the problems involved. You know, and it was just kind of funny that Mises was complaining about that, that, you know, academics can intimidate people by just giving some citation. And but, you know, he, Mises, knew, no, I've read that citation. That guy doesn't at all answer the problem of economic calculation.
Right. Or they leave out that in 1934, 12 people smashed that article. And that's sort of relevant. And, you know, because sometimes people will come at me with, Woods is a bad guy. Look what Max Boot said about him. Now, first of all people, if Max Boot likes me, I would be concerned. So people will say, this goes to show what a terrible guy he is. But the thing is, I did actually answer Max Boot, and then I never heard from him again. I mean, I kind of took a boot to his head, more or less, rhetorically. And I think I bested him on every single point. So I have to throw that in myself, because that's sometimes kind of left out.
So if Max Boot is having some doubts and wondering if people like him, you want to be clear that you actually do not like him.
Max, you're going to have to look elsewhere for your friends. Unless you come to me in sackcloth and ashes with an apology, then, you know, we can start fresh under those conditions. So think it over.
I'm sure he will. Yes. This show is all about building bridges, too. All right. Well, let me ask you this. When did you know you wanted to go get a PhD? Let me ask it that way.
Let's see. Initially, when I went to college, I was thinking that I would be a math teacher, if you can believe that, because I liked math. Well, I liked the math team because I was good at math, and it was fun to be in a competition.
Were you the captain of the math team, Tom?
Yeah, I was.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. That's
good. And our team did really well in those years. So we went to the state tournament twice. We went to the New England tournament once. I was on the Eastern Massachusetts All-Star team at a national competition in Pennsylvania twice. So, yeah, I was into it. So I just enjoyed that. And what I liked about teaching, because I did a lot of tutoring, was I liked explaining things, especially in an area where people had already built up a kind of resistance, where they were sure no one could explain this to them. They were sure this would be impossible for them ever to learn. And then I would sit them down and say, well, what if we try it this way? And they would say, oh, geez, if only my teacher explained it like that, I would have gotten it. And I'd say, yes, snagged another one. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed having people see things they couldn't see before. And I try to continue with that sometimes on the Tom Woods Show, and we'll talk about occasionally some complicated topic. I want to make sure I'm not using some lingo that nobody has heard before. I want to make sure I give examples that resonate with people and that aid in their understanding. So anyway, that was what I originally intended to do. I switched for a variety of reasons. I switched into history, and I decided that since I liked the idea of being in academia, because that did seem like not such a bad lifestyle after all, and you could be waging the war of ideas as kind of part of what your job is. Not that I was intending to propagandize kids in the classroom, but, you know, part of it.
I was thinking your Facebook friends are wrong about algebra.
Yeah, exactly.
That really wouldn't have worked.
No, that's right. That would have been no good. But it's not so much that I wanted to propagandize the students in the class, but that part of what an academic does is he should be going to the general public and giving, as Mises recommended, non-academic style talks, you know, not strewn with footnotes. And writing popular articles and that sort of thing. And I kind of enjoyed, I liked both the academic side and the popularizing side. And I thought I could do that a lot more easily in academia as a history professor than as a high school math teacher. I mean, why would anybody care what I had to say anyway as a high school math teacher?
Well, hang on though. Let me ask you. So when you were imagining your life as a math teacher, you were thinking at the high school level?
I was, yeah. I never occurred to me to be at the college. I thought I would coach the math team.
And when did that transition? Were you an undergrad college student when you saw the professors in real? And that's also, I think, when you started getting more into political controversies. Is that when you?
It was that. Yeah, it was that. And it was also meeting the other math students and realizing that all they do is math. Even in their spare time, all they're doing is reading number theory books and things like that. And since in my spare time, I felt like I had a lot of knowledge gaps to fill in a variety of subjects, I was reading a wide variety of things. And I thought, I'm not sure I can compete with people who do nothing else, nothing else. And that it's that, I mean, and obviously I could have, but it still made me feel it was a concern. And so then I looked at my schedule and I realized, wait a minute, in order to get a lot of requirements out of the way, I had taken quite a few electives in my first year, including plenty of history. And I realized, hey, wait, if I major in history, this counts. This all counts toward the major. And so now I'm swimming in a sea of electives. Well, this isn't such a bad idea. And yeah, sure, I could see myself doing this for a living. And so I began to think that was what I wanted to do. And so I need the PhD.
Okay. So as an undergrad, you were a major in history?
Yes.
Okay. Well, since you bring up the PhD, something I just realized, I don't know, maybe I heard and forgot, in which case I apologize. What was your actual doctoral dissertation on?
Oh, time preference theory.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, wait, that's yours. Sorry. Oh,
I'm like, yeah, I actually fell for that.
Oh, that was good.
Well, because I was thinking maybe like you meant like the history of,
yeah, the history
thought
of thought
or something.
Yeah, and, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. You know, that would have come up over the years.
Oh my gosh, right, that's so stupid on my part. Okay, look at this. Yeah, I got zinged on my first episode. All right.
Yeah, but Bob, do you know how many times I've been zinged? First of all, by you. It's about time. You know, if I can get 800 more in, we'll level the playing field. But no, actually, my dissertation, it ended up getting published as a book. I expanded it a bit, and it was published as a book that Columbia University Press published called The Church Confronts Modernity. And it was about American Catholic Church during the Progressive Era, but really about intellectual life. I'm not interested in legislation and stuff like that. So even then, I wasn't really drawn to that kind of study. But I was always interested in the Progressive Era in that you never in your textbook read about anybody who was an opponent of anything going on in the Progressive Era. It's all, well, yeah, this is all common sense stuff. Of course, everybody was in favor. There's not even a hint of debate or discussion or anything. I thought there had to be some. Somebody must have disagreed with something in the Progressive Era. This is ridiculous. So I thought to myself, I'm pretty sure Catholic intellectuals would not have, for example, favored John Dewey's approach to education or William James's approach to philosophy or whatever. So I started looking at old Catholic periodicals, and I looked at old manuscript collections from a lot of writers, and I found, yeah, this is exactly what was going on. There was actually a low-level intellectual civil war going on. And the Catholic consensus seemed to be that what was going on in the Progressive Era, which has been missed by most people, was that a lot of these intellectuals were saying, what we need now, given that every reasonable person knows that religion is dead, what we need is some kind of national creed to substitute for it. Because we need something to glue us together. And so what we need is Hamiltonian nationalism to glue the states together. And you read about that, that's what the progressives all believed. And then we also need some kind of a non-denominational creed that we can cling to that will be non-dogmatic and that will involve virtues like open-mindedness and willingness to change and flexibility and all that. And of course, Catholic intellectuals were saying, well, this kind of sounds like it's directed at us, doesn't it? Because in fact, John Dewey thought one of the greatest atrocities ever was the Catholic school system, because he thought his schools were giving the children the chance to go and be intellectually curious. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, look at the schools today. Yeah, a lot of intellectual curiosity is allowed in there. But they viewed this as a kind of assault on them. Well, wait a minute. How does the Catholic faith fit in here if what you're trying to do is build this brand new secular creed from scratch? They felt like they're trying to shove us out of the public square. So I wrote about this, and this had not been done. And this is like the holy grail of PhD dissertations, because it's so hard with so much subsidy for higher education to find a topic that has genuinely not been done. Everything's been done. It's hopeless. That's why doctoral dissertations have titles like Wage Rate Trends in Appalachian Coal Miners, you know, in 1887. Even that's too broad. But I actually found something that genuinely hadn't been done. And so when I defended the dissertation, one of the professors on the committee was actually the editor of a series of books for Columbia University Press called Religion in American Life. And he came to me and said, I would love to publish this dissertation in that series. This is really important stuff you've uncovered. He said, since you have my approval, you'd need only one more peer review, and then we'd be off to the races. So I wrote some more for it, made it book length, got that extra peer review, and it became by far my most critically well-received work. I mean, when you think of what are the major journals in my field, the Journal of American History gave it a glowing review. I got very favorable comments in the American Historical Review, in the Journal of the Historical Society, in Choice, which is the is not the Bob Murphy book. It's the journal for academic libraries about which books they should be acquiring. And it just goes down the line. It was just very well received. And that was just a nice feather in my cap, I think.
Let's pause a minute, Tom, for me to be able to keep the lights on. Well, folks, if you like this interview I'm doing with Tom Woods right now, you know what you're going to love? The book Contra Krugman, authored by me, because it is narrated by, wait for it, Tom Woods himself. That's right, folks. It's a collection of some of my greatest anti-Krugman essays from over the years. They were published in all different outlets. I'm guessing, even if you're one of my longtime fans, you haven't read all of these columns because they were scattered all over the place, and we've collected them in one volume for you. Again, Tom's narrating. It was great. He had to read 600 pages of my stuff. I think he probably learned some economics, too. For more details, go to ContraKrugmanBook.com. That's Contra with a C, ContraKrugmanBook.com, all one word. Okay, well, that's interesting, Tom. And I wondered, so I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but do you have a bunch of peer-reviewed history articles also? Like, were you at one point, going to try to get tenure? I'm sorry, when I met you, you know, you were at the Mises Institute. We were both teaching at Mises University, I believe. And so that's, you know, you are already sort of going down the path of really weird, unpopular stuff as far as the mainstream is concerned. So I'm wondering, though, at one point, it was your say, I'm just going to sit here and check the boxes and do stuff that gets critical acclaim from a variety of sources and get my tenure track job. And
yeah, I mean, I do have publications in peer-reviewed journals of a variety of kinds, but I stopped doing it after a while because I came to the conclusion that I want to write things that are going to be widely read. It's no longer that important to me that I say to the profession, here's a new bit of research I'm doing, and I think it advances the field. I felt like with that book from Columbia, that advanced that area. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly what the Journal of American History said, that Woods has opened an area of study that deserves further investigation. I felt like, all right, if I can say I've done that, then good. And I liked also, the thing is, maybe it's my attention span. I don't know what it is, but I just can't stay focused on just one thing or one area. I've never aspired to be the expert on the 1920s or something, or the expert on gender in the progressive era or something. That just has no interest for me at all. I like that I can jump from one topic to another. Like, I can go from writing that book to writing, a book on Catholic liturgy or a book on the financial crisis, or a book on Catholic social teaching that kind of takes a fresh look at it. And I like that. And I began to think of myself as being a generalist. I felt like I'd made all the contributions I would need to be tenured. And then I kind of also came to the conclusion that I don't want to live my life where I have to constantly hide my views. And bear in mind, Bob, I think even 15 years ago, academia was different from how it is now. I think it was... It wasn't like a sea of toleration by any means, but it was a much, much more congenial place for me then than I think it would be today. And so I felt like I could get away with just writing what I wanted to write, and I rolled the dice, and that ended up working out. Plus, by 2006, I was at the Mises Institute full time, and for all I knew, I was going to stay there forever. I ended up moving just for family reasons, but at that point, who cares what my views are? Nobody at the Mises Institute minds if I have a negative view of Franklin Roosevelt or something. That's not going to hurt me. So I was very fortunate in that I just was able to do what I wanted to do, especially from that moment on.
Okay, well, let me ask you this now that we're talking about this particular topic. I don't know if this question is going to make sense to you, but I understand what it means for someone to be a good economist. And I don't just mean, oh, he likes the free market. Like, for example, when I'm doing the economics of climate change, I will say, the work of William Nordhaus was one of the pioneers in that field, and Krugman studied under him. I'll say he's at least a good economist in that he understands there's marginal costs and benefits, and that, in his model, it only makes sense to mitigate emissions up to the point at which on the margin it's balanced, that it would cost the economy more in output to reduce emissions by one more ton of CO2 than you avoid in climate change damage. Whereas other people, they don't even like Krugman doesn't even talk in terms of marginal costs and benefits when he writes in the New York Times on climate change. So that's what I mean when I say Nordhaus is at least a good economist. So Tom, with that analogy, what's a good historian? You know what I'm saying? Like, are there historians that, like, guys you respect? They say, oh yeah, this guy's a good historian, even though, for I know he's a Marxist or something, but you see what I'm saying? Is there a way that when you think of, like, what would it mean for someone to be a good historian? Because I think for people who are outside that area, it's like, well, I mean, all you got to do is go and say, in this date, this happened, and then on this date, this happened. And I realize that's not what historians do. But
yeah, that's true. This is a much harder question to answer than what makes a good economist. And in fact, over the years, I'll take a shot at it, but I'm not convinced that I've really reached a good answer to this question. In majoring in history, you go through courses and seminars where they are talking about the craft of the historian and all that. And it always just sounded to me like a lot of bunk, like a lot of stuff to try to intimidate amateur historians into thinking, well, you don't have this credential that we have, that we earned by sitting in these boring seminars all day, so nobody should take seriously what you're writing. And I just don't go for that. I think that a reasonably educated person who has some basics down about the use of sources can do some good history and have done some perfectly good history. So I would say, for example, let me think about, here's a guy I don't often praise, and that's Eric Foner. Eric Foner, the whole Foner family was known for Marxism and left-wing politics. Foner was a professor at Columbia when I was doing my graduate work there, and I avoided him completely. Whereas most people go to Columbia and they say, oh, what a privilege, I'll get to study with Eric Foner. I thought, get this guy away from me. He's a horrible propagandist. But he wrote a great book on Thomas Paine. And you look at that book and you think that's how you write history, because you read that, Paine comes across in a non-distorted way. There's no agenda, at least that I could perceive, in that book. And you could cheer Tom Paine in that book. And just the book is Tom Paine rather than Eric Foner. That's a very hard thing to manage. For example, there were a lot of biographies of Ronald Reagan that came out in 1989 when obviously things were still a bit hot in terms of how you felt about Reagan. And it showed in those books. I was learning much more about the author than I was about the subject. But that's not true in the case of Foner and his book on Tom Paine. But the thing is, I would say, obviously you have to be steeped in the primary works. But you also need to have a passing acquaintance with the secondary literature. What have people's interpretations been, if only so that you can correct them and bring to the table the correct interpretation. Now, also, when you're doing work where you're kind of the pioneer, you're the first person to really sit there and do it, this was something that Alan Brinkley taught me. He was my dissertation director.
And he's David Brinkley's dad or son?
Son.
Okay.
Yeah. And you and I are old enough to kind of remember This Week with David Brinkley. So to me, it was kind of neat to study with Alan Brinkley. But he said, a lot of times when you read a book on history and you'll get to some chapter where it'll say, now the turning point came here, and you don't stop to think, wait a minute, that's a historical judgment to say the turning point came here. A historian had to look at the evidence and say, this was the turning point. He said to me, what's missing in your work is you never say anything like, now the turning point came when blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, the funny thing is, because historians have not done this, I don't already have it preformed in my mind what the turning points are. So my instincts aren't already firing out signals to me that I should be saying this. Mm-hmm. So I realized, wait a minute, I need to just say it. I need to declare it. I need to make a judgment as a historian. I need to tell the audience, this is the moment, because I've looked at all the evidence and it seems to me like things really changed after this particular event. Yeah. So I realized that's what I have to be doing.
So you put in the turning point was when they abandoned the traditional mass. And that's when.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, that one was kind of obvious. But it's things like that. It's making those kinds of judgments. But the thing is, the question kind of that's related to this is objectivity. Is there a possibility that you can be truly objective in what you're doing? And this is probably somewhat hopeless because, of course, even the selection of topics is laden with value judgments. But you can at least be open that there is more than one way of thinking about the question, that some people say this and other people say this. Now, my judgment comes down on this side, but there are people who say the other. You can still do that. Now, you could say, Woods, wait a minute, though. in your politically incorrect guide to American history, I don't get the sense that there are two sides to questions. Well, in there, I plead Rush Limbaugh, because Rush Limbaugh used to be told, you need to give people equal time. And his answer always was, you remember, I am equal time. So that book was equal time. But in general, it's quite possible to at least briefly acquaint people with the state of the historical debate on something. And I think that makes you a good historian.
And also, I mean, I totally get how somebody could say those politically incorrect guidebooks are one-sided. But as you say, I mean, by their very nature, what we do, I would say it's almost, I would almost flip it and say, no, just about any other series in the world, this clearly lays out what the opposing viewpoint is. Because our whole point is to say, this is what everybody teaches you, and here's another way to think about it.
Right, 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 exactly. Yeah, and so that's true. I did a government course for the Ron Paul curriculum. And in that, of course, I'm overturning basically everything people are taught about government. But in order to do that, you have to begin by laying out what it is that they're taught. And then, so at least they know there are two perspectives, even if I lean toward one of them.
And as I think Bumbavar more than anybody showed, the way to really destroy something is to build up your opponent's case even better than the opponent does, such that you've got the reader almost thinking, yeah, that sounds like it's right. And then you just blow it up six different ways. And so,
yeah, that's amazing about Bumbavar.
Yeah. So far from, you know, doing a straw man version, if you think you're right and you really want to convince the intelligent reader, you don't want to do a disservice when you summarize the view of your opponent. You want to make it as strong as possible.
Yeah, that was always the Thomas Aquinas way.
It's what you bring him. That was, I have, you know, obviously here a list of topics to bring. Let me ask you that. So I went to Aquinas High School, but and when I went to Hillsdale, I was like eligible for some kind of scholarship. And so you go for, I think what they called it, merit weekend, you know, to let you know that you might get a merit scholarship. And it wasn't because of my quarterbacking skills. I think a lot of the listeners will be surprised to hear that. And she was like the super Catholic professor that was there. And she said, oh, tell us about, you know, Thomistic thought or something. And I just punted. And I said, no, I went to Aquinas High School. I don't know anything. And so in one of your episodes, Tom, you walked through Aquinas's, one of his proofs for the existence of God, which is an amazing episode. And I'm wondering, in your view, like how big is Aquinas? Like, is Aquinas up there with Aristotle and such, or is it? Just comment on that for those of us who aren't familiar with his work. Like, should people who are non-Catholic, number one, or even non-believers at all, number two, should they go be reading his stuff on the natural law because that's just how amazing he is?
They should read him. It's interesting to note that Ayn Rand thought very highly of Thomas Aquinas.
I can't remember. Was she a Methodist? What was her?
Yeah, exactly. Despite his religious commitment, she found a great deal that, and I raise her not because she's the summit of philosophy by any means, but just to show that even somebody who is deeply opposed to his most cherished views can find something of value in what he wrote. I mean, it's amazing that he didn't even live quite a half century, and yet he produced, I think it was like 1225 to 1274, and he produced just an enormous amount. And I have the Summa Theologiae on my shelf, and it's a series of questions and answers. And you can just look in the table of contents and find all kinds of different questions on all kinds of different topics, and then just go right to that, see what he had to say. Then it's laid out in this kind of format where it's the question, and then he's got supports for one side, then he answers and gives you his side, refutes all those supports, you know, and et cetera. Every single question over and over and over and over and over again. Then you have the Summa Contra Gentiles, which is where he does in the Summa Theologiae talk about those. He has five proofs for demonstrating God's existence, but he doesn't really go into much detail on them there. He goes into the detail in a more traditional prose style work, the Summa Contra Gentiles, which is just to see a really great mind at work wrestling with a difficult problem, and also to see him bringing in commentary from non-Catholic sources. I mean, from Aristotle, certainly, and obviously from some church fathers, but also from Muslims like Avicenna and Averroes and Jewish thinkers like Maimonides, and just saying, what can I learn and what can I bring to bear here that can help me get the answer to this question? And so it's the kind of thing you would want modern university life to emulate, that here are these people who have vastly different opinions from me, but I'm going to scour them for what insight I can get on particular questions I'm investigating. You know, I mean, doesn't it makes the medieval university system sound like an example of free thought compared to what exists today. So for those sorts of reasons, he definitely ought to be read. And within the Catholic Church, I mean, he's referred to as the angelic doctor, and he was viewed as the lodestar of theology, that if you're going to teach theology, it's got to be rooted in Thomas Aquinas. Now, that's in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, they started to slightly move away from that with disastrous consequences, but he's still held in, you know, I mean, he's the patron saint of scholars, and he's still held in enormously high regard.
See, it's funny, because I always thought that during the Dark Ages, the Catholic Church did everything it could to suppress intellectual inquiry. You're saying that's a little bit of a mischaracterization?
Yeah, it's like when I hear stuff like that, it's like hearing Paul Krugman explaining Austrian business cycle theory. You know, because all his fans are cheering him on. Yeah, Paul, you're really getting him.
Stick it to him.
Right. Yeah. And we're thinking, he hasn't read anything on the Austrian business cycle theory. And so, yeah, I've written on this too, whether it's, again, I think people think, well, the church's view is shut up and believe and don't ask any questions. Well, somebody forgot to tell Thomas Aquinas that, because his whole work is questions. And the whole university system was centered around the asking of questions, because the process of a disputation, which would go on very frequently in university life, and in fact, if you wanted to get your degree, you had to adjudicate one of these, where you'd have people taking sides of some controversial philosophical or theological question, and they would hash it out and argue it out, and then it would be up to somebody to somehow resolve what had been heard into some kind of answer. And it wasn't necessarily that one side is right and the other side is wrong. It was rather, how do we take these what seem to be valid arguments on both sides and either come up with some kind of synthesis or draw something worthwhile from both? Again, this sounds like something out from Mars compared to – could you imagine that being the attitude in a debate today on a college campus, if they would even allow the debate to occur?
Yeah, it is funny. And of course, folks, it's not that I or even Tom is saying, yeah, every single move done by the Catholic Church with regard to scientific inquiry in the last 2,000 years has been completely what we would have done. That's not the issue. But the caricature, when you see the facts, like I remember, Tom, my son one time, he started matter of fact, this was several years ago, he started matter of factly telling me something about like the controversy with between Newton and I forget the other guy's name about who invented calculus. And he started just matter-of-factly telling
me. Oh, Leibniz.
Yeah, telling me stuff about how the church was, you know, locking up Galileo and all this stuff. And I kind of, and I said, where did you get that from? And he was like, oh, because I watched Cosmos. And it was like Neil deGrasse Tyson or somebody was narrating the thing. And I went, yeah, well, I've seen some stuff online from like historians of science and that stuff's not really accurate. And, you know, and he goes, oh, okay. And then like later that day, he's talking to me, matter of fact, he goes, hey Dad, did you know that it takes light 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth? And I was like, oh yeah. And he goes, oh, wait a minute. I heard that from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Maybe that's not right.
Oh, that's funny.
So it was interesting. Like, you know, I mean, it made sense that he was quite, and I had to clarify like, no, I'm sure he has that kind of information correct. What I mean is, so it's interesting. Since we're talking about it, why don't we, and obviously, the longtime listeners know that I was raised Catholic and now I'm Protestant. But what I didn't realize, Tom, is that you went the other way. And let me just say at the outset, folks, Tom and I are not here going to debate this issue, first of all, because this is going to be a friendly conversation, but also because Tom would destroy me, I'm sure, if we actually tried to have a debate right now. So for you Protestants out there, it's for your own good that I'm not facing him right here. Not because I'm wrong, of course, but just because Tom is a master of rhetoric. But can you – you mentioned it like offhand once on the Contra Cruise. Somebody asked something, and I didn't realize. I assumed you had been born and raised a Catholic, and that's not the case, right?
See, another reason to go on the Contra Cruise. You learn things about people that, you know, maybe you would never have had these informal conversations before. So ContraCruise.com. So the we're even doing it on the Bob Murphy Show. The situation there was, I can't remember when I told, might have been with Steve Patterson that I told the story, but the long and the short of it is I was raised not really in a church. I was baptized, but I was not really raised in a church. I had no denominational affiliation. I was never anti-Christian. I always felt like these seemed like friendly enough people to me. And, you know, I hope they have happy lives. I had nothing against them. And then I went to college and I had somebody who approached me, who I was becoming friends with, and he said to me over lunch, You got to start asking yourself some real questions, important questions. I mean, this is what college is all about. I mean, do you believe in truth or don't you? Well, of course I believe. What kind of a question is that? Of course I believe in truth. Well, you can see where this is going. By the end of the conversation, he had corralled me into going to church with him in Cambridge, Massachusetts, by the way, which is a little bit left of center. And so when we went to that church and there was a preacher there who preached very matter-of-factly and very firmly from a point of view of moral absolutes, and I just thought, wow, that guy has guts to be talking this way in the middle of Harvard Square. And so I was kind of impressed by that. And he gave me this book, he being this friend, called Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? I don't know if you've seen it, Bob, but it's a transcript of a debate between Gary Habermas and the man who at that time was one of the best known atheists in philosophy, Anthony Flew. And they were actually just looking at what we know from historical evidence. And Habermas was arguing that we can confidently say that Christ did rise from the dead. And it turned out that the 5-person panel of judges, well, 3 of them said that Habermas won the debate. And that amazed me because I would have thought it would be 0.
Mm-hmm.
Because how could he win that debate? He seemed like to me would have to lose. So that at least cracked into my presuppositions. And so I was able to now look at things more dispassionately without any preconceived ideas. And so anyway, so I did wind up as a Protestant. I went through several denominations as a Protestant. That would bore everybody to death. But the one that I...
Oh, so the guy who at lunch was provoking you, he was a Protestant?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry
okay.
I left out that crucial detail.
Well, I mean, because I actually, I'm that makes more sense to me because they tend to be more, you know, proselytizing than Catholics do.
Yeah, so, exactly. Okay. Yeah, exactly right. So yeah, he was. And so, you know, this... See, he went to a non-denominational, like sort of charismatic or Pentecostal style church, and that is just not my thing.
Did you handle snakes, Tom?
I did not,
okay.
But it was borderline, and that's just not for me. But anyway, I was a Lutheran by the end of it, and but I became Catholic. I mean, it's a bunch of things, but I just thought that there were arguments against Protestantism that I just thought, yeah, I know obviously there are Protestants I can find who can wiggle their way out of these arguments. I get it. But, you know, that's true of almost any argument about anything. You can always find somebody who's going to think milk subsidies are a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he could maybe
defend
even make
nullification. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, right, exactly. But you could even find somebody who could make a plausible sounding argument. That's not going to stop me from changing my mind. And I just felt like there were a number of problems with it. And then combine that with I started going to – again, I thought I'll give everything a chance. I started going to – I went to something called Eucharistic Adoration, which is something in the church that the liturgical reformers had not really touched. And so it still had the whiff of the ancient to it. And between that and a lot of reading I was doing in my spare time, I began to think that this is probably really where I belong, and this one makes the most sense. But that's the really gliding over all the details version. But so 1996 is where this all dates to.
Okay, interesting. Let me ask you, this is going to be a bit provocative, and I'm talking sociologically. I think you'll see why I'm using that. Is that an adverb? Yes. So I'm not talking about doctrine, but looking at where you stand in these debates and intellectual life and so forth, I'm going to give you an analogy and you tell me if I'm crazy. All right. So if you were going to go from theology and then make an analogy with political philosophy, I would say Martin Luther is Murray Rothbard, John Calvin is Hans Hoppe, and the Catholic Church is the Heritage Foundation. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Yes, you are. Geez. Well, there's so many ways I could answer that, Bob. But obviously, first of all, on economics, come on now. I mean, I know you're not talking about economics. I know you're talking about, you know, theology.
You get what I'm saying. The thing about it. I didn't pick this analogy just off, like it's in terms of the, you know, but like someone could say of Luther or especially Calvin, like, yeah, he's got this one thing he latched onto and he's like following that to its logical conclusion to the exclusion of all.
I get it.
And that's what people say. Okay, I'm just...
I totally get it. So he spins out the whole institutes basically from he's got one fundamental insight and it blossoms into this whole system?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? So that's like Rothbard has an insight and it blossoms?
And he's unreasonable and doesn't have any like common sense judgment and, you know, yes, I could see why someone thinks they're being consistent with this stuff, but come on. Like, that's kind of what the reaction is to, especially a Calvin or something. And so
yeah, that's true. On the other hand, I think Keynes had one insight, which is that the market economy is unstable left to its own devices, and he spins a whole theory out of that. So that in and of itself is necessary but not sufficient. How about that?
Okay, fair enough. All right. So let me see. We got you just for a few more minutes here. I want to respect your time. Another big thing with you that people, I mean, they know if they've seen you, but how is it? You're a very good public speaker. I don't want to embarrass him, but my dad one time, we had you guys come in, if you remember, Tom, Carlos Lahr and I had these events that we called the Night of Clarity in downtown Nashville for a few years there. And you were our keynote speaker in the beginning until we got somebody more famous like Ron Paul. But for a while, you were the best.
But not as cheap.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yes. It was a cost benefit. Dollar for dollar, you were probably the best guy we brought in.
Thanks.
And my dad actually told me, he said something like after, he said, you know, Bob, you used to be the best public speaker I'd ever heard, but now it's Tom.
Ah.
I was like, oh, thanks, Dad. And so, you know, and I have to win back his approval. So I want to know, did you do debate or something when you were younger? I'm just wondering, like, how did you get to be at the point where, and people who haven't seen you, I mean, folks, it really is. When I go now to hear Tom give a talk, it's like him, Judge Napolitano, maybe a few other people where I'm not really listening to the content so much. It's that I'm studying to see like the techniques, like how is it these guys just take the room over instantly? Nobody's dozing off. So I noticed, for example, Tom, what Judge Napolitano would do if he's in a smaller setting, he walks out into the crowd and like asks people questions about like the Bill of Rights or something. So nobody's dozing off because this crazy guy might get in my face and ask me what the Fourth Amendment is. So things like that. So anyway, I'm just setting it up here and letting you go loose. But how did you get to the point where you were giving opening speeches for Ron Paul in a, you know, crowds of many thousands of people and getting them fired up? Whereas some people literally, I mean, that's their nightmare, to public speaking. And yet you're a pro at it.
I think some of it probably has a little to do with my being in drama as a kid. I did a lot of that.
Oh, you're a drama queen.
Yeah,
I forgot
that's
about
right.
That's
right. Yeah. But I was in quite a few plays. I even did a couple of local television commercials, believe it or not. So first of all, certainly made me comfortable.
Okay, hang on. I have to stop right here. I'm going to have my folks. Guys, we need to get all of these. Like, is it like you're doing Ovaltine or something? Can we get the thing of you as a 12-year-old saying you got a tummy ache?
Well, they're just local commercials. So one of them, for example, was and thing is, we had it on videotape and heaven knows where it is now. Because, so thankfully before the internet. So it's gone. But the idea was
if Nick Sarwar gets his hands in that, it's over.
but it's so funny though, because the main one that I did was, it was for a local, you know, local cable TV company. And the idea was to encourage viewers to consider advertising on cable. So the theme is, it shows me this nerdy kid. Yes, I was typecast already. It shows me sitting there trying to get customers for my lemonade stand. I've got no customers. And then it shows me researching, and I'm typing into a computer. There's no internet in those days. So how I was researching this on the computer, I have no idea. But the computer is telling me that cable TV targets your audience, it's economical, and it's effective. So I said, all right, I'll try. So it shows me then making a commercial, and then I'm sitting in a lounge chair relaxing while an employee deals with all the many customers I have. So it was fun. I mean, that was kind of fun.
This is amazing. I mean, here we thought you went from being an academic to an online marketing guy. And now we realize, no, the academia was the detour.
Right.
From like little, from a young age,
right.
You were a marketing
I was
genius.
Doing that stuff in those days. Yeah. But anyway, certainly being on a stage makes you comfortable in front of an audience. And that is one of the key things, is being comfortable. Because you can tell when somebody is nervous. And I see that in some of our young Austrians who may, let's say, be teaching or speaking at an event and we're in the audience, and you can tell when they're terrified. And I mean, I have tips for people on stuff like that, but
they have to get on your, they have to join the Tom Woods supporting listeners
instance,
to get those tips.
You have to remember.
I was going to say, because this would be a good place to say some of those tips.
I was just afraid I was going to interrupt myself, but I'll just say, certainly one thing to remember, and you have to force yourself to remember it, is that there's nobody in that audience who wants you to fail.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to learn something from you. Why else would they be in the audience? Nobody shows up, especially at an academic event or a Ron Paul rally. Nobody says, I'm going to go to that Ron Paul rally because I hope one of the speakers chokes.
Exactly.
It would never dawn on them. They want you to be successful. So, and especially the larger the crowd, the easier it is. It is hard to speak to a room of 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, because it's I don't know why I feel like it's like when you go to a restaurant that has no music playing in the background.
Yep.
It's just weird. Like you have to, we feel like you have to whisper, you know, as if something's not right about it. And then secondly, you're not going to get as many laughs.
Here's something that I noticed. And so I'm not really, folks, I'm saying Tom is like a higher level than me. So I'm saying the closest I got to glimpsing this phenomenon is it was when the Tea Party was big, Tom, and I got invited to go give a talk at one of the Tea Party rallies. It was at Fifth Third Arena in, I think it was Cincinnati, if that makes sense. It's probably named some, but it was like really a big professional basketball stadium. And so I'm by no means were the bleachers all full, but I mean, it was a huge venue and there were many thousands of people in there. So by far the biggest thing I had done. And I realized, and what I did is I just walked out into the middle of the basketball court. I made a joke in the beginning, folks, about saying, I don't want to stay here because otherwise I'll get a 3-second violation. Cause I was like in the paint for those of you. So I was like bonding with the guys, you know, it was good stuff. And so I go out and I'm like at half court basically. And I'm just like speaking and turning. And I had no notes. Cause I knew if I had notes or if I was out by a podium, I would just be like in my own little protective cocoon and that wasn't going to work. And what I noticed, Tom, is it was extremely easy to get applause for the lines that I knew should be applause lines. Because with a crowd that big, if I just said the provocative thing, you know, like, oh, and Obama wants to take over the energy sector. Oh, I don't see him trying to take over the milkshake sector, but notice he wants to take over the energy sector. And I just stop. Somebody's going to start clapping and then everyone starts clapping. Whereas if it were only 100 people in there, they might all just sit there looking at me and I'd be an idiot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly the dynamic. You have a whole bunch of people. There are bound to be at least a few who have some kind of funny laugh or who laugh at everything, which thereby subconsciously gives other people the permission to laugh. And then it just extends from there. Plus, there's energy in a room with a lot of people.
Yep.
You know, that there isn't in the so for example, the best example of this would be the rally for the Republic, in my case. I'm talking about from my speaking career. The best example was Ron Paul's Rally for the Republic 2008, the Target Center in Minneapolis. It's the same week they're nominating John McCain in St. Paul. So we're in the other one of the Twin Cities. It was an amazing event. And by the time I spoke well before him on that day, and there were probably by that point maybe 6,000 people in the audience. I'm estimating maybe 7,000 people in the audience. And that was by far the most fun I've had. Or at least it's definitely way up there, I'll say that. Because everything I said, they loved. Everything I said. And I was just improvising after a while. I mean, and the thing is, it's hard to improvise when there's a clock running. They had to keep that thing timed strictly. It's hard. You got to keep your eye on the clock. But I mentioned Austrian business cycle theory, and that got a cheer. It got applause and cheers. And I just could not help noting how different this convention was from the Republican convention down the street. I said, let's go ask, and I invented this line on the spot. I said, let's go ask John McCain what he knows about business cycle theory. We may as well be speaking in Chinese. And I mean, it was just, everybody was just eating out of the palm of my hand. So anyway, that's something to bear in mind.
Tom, I'm going to ask you, don't insult dead people on this show.
I couldn't help it. This particularly dead person doesn't know much about business cycle theory, but that's true of almost all dead people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I've probably insulted all dead people. But all right, well, the thing is, in terms of success with it, certainly you do not want to read off a paper, okay? Maybe at an academic conference, that's acceptable. And even then,
You mean like you're literally reading the speech you wrote? No, that never works.
But I just mean, when I'm at an academic conference and somebody's reading his paper, I feel like, all right, well, he's a professor. He doesn't do, you know, all right. He's not a crowd pleaser by definition. Okay, fair enough. But even then, I agree, you shouldn't do that. What I have is I just have some notes. I have some quotations, things I want to quote in front of me. And then I just have some notes because you have to be comfortable with your subject matter. You have to feel like if I just go up there with some notes, I can riff for half an hour to an hour. If you're not at that level, then it's not going to work out. You got to have that level of knowledge. You have to be able to explain things, but not be bogged down in long chains of logical connections. So if you're, I mean, obviously, if you're lecturing in a college classroom, that's different. But if you're just doing what most people are doing with public speaking, which is speaking to a crowd of mostly well-wishers, they're not going to remember anything you say 2 weeks from now anyway, and they're certainly not going to remember long chains of reasoning. So you want to simplify. And if you're just dying to give them more detail, then, you know, send them to your website. You know, send them to something where you have more detail. But the thing is, a lot of the best stuff I do as a public speaker just occurs to me while I'm doing it. Some of my, by far my funniest lines just occur to me on the spot. I hadn't planned any of them. I go up there and I say, oh, this one's going to be boring. But then I start talking and I'm building off the energy of the room and jokes just occur to me. And I mean, I'm at my funniest by far. People meet me in real life and I'm not that funny and they're disappointed. That, geez, all these YouTube videos have lied to me. I don't know what it is about that. And let me say something actually that people can learn from your experience. And you've heard me say this to you before. I can date. I can't actually remember the date, but I could look it up. I can pinpoint the exact moment that you became five times better as a public speaker. Do you remember what it was?
Was it when I was making fun of you for the Human Action Study Guide?
It was the Human Action Study Guide. Yeah, it was that thing.
Yeah.
We were at the Mises Institute, what was at that time called the Austrian Scholars Conference. And Bob had created the Study Guide to Human Action. And so that was, you know, that's a new book. So he's going to speak as part of the new book panel. And I must have had a new book that year because I think we were both speaking on that. I can't remember, but maybe I did. The point is, we were expected to speak for 15 or 20 minutes about our, you know, each person's new book. And Bob had not realized that he was expected to do much of anything other than just say, yeah, hey, I wrote this book and hope you go like it.
No, let me interrupt.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I didn't realize at all. Like, I was literally told maybe 10 minutes before we were going on that I was going to give this to. I didn't even realize I was on the panel.
Oh, okay. So that's even, okay. Yeah.
Right.
So you didn't even, okay. So,
and that's why it produced the result that you're describing for the listeners.
You got up there with no preparation because how could you have any preparation? You had to just talk.
Right.
And you were just talking about something you knew inside and out. You wrote the study guide. And it was so great. It was so fantastic. It was so funny. And my favorite line I've never forgotten was, I don't know if you remember this one, but you said something like, it won't be as good as the way you said it, but you said, now I know people look at Human Action, it's a really long book, and why should I read that book when there are, you know, all kinds of illegal drugs I could go try?
Yeah.
And that was just a throwaway line. I just people laughed hysterically at that. Nobody expected you to say that. It was such a great moment.
Actually, Tom, hang on. I'm getting a sign from the guys in the booth there. They're saying they've got some of the audio from that talk I gave. This was back in 2009, explaining in a 15-minute or so talk to the fans at the Austrian Scholars Conference about my new book, which was the Human Action Study Guide. We'll link to this in the show notes page for this, the Bob Murphy Show, episode one, of course. But here's two quick excerpts they've grabbed from that I think you folks will enjoy, especially given that I'm here talking to Tom Woods right now.
I noticed listening to the other people talk that Tom Woods went first, I'm going last, and I think they did that on purpose because in many respects, Tom's talk is the exact opposite. His experience with his books were the opposite of mine. So one thing is, of course, he gets royalties for his books, and that's why he's a big showman. On the other hand, you know, I got a lump sum for this. I really don't care if you buy this or not at this point. Whereas Tom is going to be, like, he has a trench coat. He's like, hey, come here. Did you hear about the Constitution? That's a nice watch you got there. I'll sign it for the watch. What do you think? That's Tom's. And I've heard people literally saying things to the effect of, well, there's no way I'm going to sit down and read Human Action. Why, you know, I got, illegal drugs to go try. You know, that's their... I hope there's a delay with the video so they can cut that out. And so it'll flash a picture of Mises. We're experiencing technical difficulties.
Yes, good stuff. And another thing, folks, if you want to go click on the link that we'll put in the show notes page to see the actual video of that talk, I'm such a youthful lad. I've got a freshly shaved face. It's great stuff. Now that I got the beard and I'm sort of older, wiser, manlier, it's good to go see that. Okay, Tom, but I thought the folks would like that brief digression. Back to our scintillating conversation.
And then likewise, I had something like that happen in 2005. The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History had come out at the end of 2004, and I was slated to go do a book signing at a Barnes & Noble that my publisher had set up. So I show up there. I figure I'm going to sign some books. And in fact, I told the family, you know, this won't be long. I'll be home in a little while. I'm just going to go sign some books. So I get there, and the store manager says, oh, we're so delighted to have you. Here's your book table. And C-SPAN is just setting up over in the corner. And I said, I beg your pardon? Oh, yeah, C-SPAN. you're going to be delivering remarks tonight? They expected me to give an hour speech. I didn't know that. Publisher never said a word about C-SPAN being there. So I thought, oh, this is, I mean, okay, I could just give a spontaneous speech if I absolutely had to. But does it have to be televised? Really? I have to try this out on TV. And that also turned out to be great. It just turned out to be absolutely great. Now, that's probably not going to be a general rule that works for everybody. But the principle to draw from it is that what you want to be shooting for is to, I wouldn't say be unrehearsed, but to have a flavor of spontaneity to it.
Spontaneity.
And so that you don't seem like a robot.
Yeah.
And that were, and by the way, one other thing is most people speak way too fast when they do public speaking. Or when they're in a play. When the people are in a play, especially kids, when kids like age 14 and under are in a play, they speak four times faster than they should. No one can understand a word they're saying because we don't have a script in front of us. We can follow along and it's hard to follow you. And especially when you want people to follow an argument, slow it down. Slow it down. That's going to make you much, much more effective. All right. So anyway, that's that. I could probably say more, but I think we're hitting it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's exactly what I wanted. And by that, I mean you praising me and reminding people of when I really just showed you that I was an up and coming star.
It was awesome.
But for real, folks, Tom is right that that's why that happened. Because up till that point, I was very, you know, because it is intimidating. And so for those, especially those of you who are Mises scholars who have been speaking and you're like, oh, no, is Tom saying that I look nervous? Yes, you do. But also we're saying we understand why. And I was also, I can see like lectures I gave, like my first Mises U and whatever. By the way, Tom, and now we're swapping inside stories. My first talk at Mises U, well, I don't know if it was my first, but it was the first Mises U at which I was speaking. And I believe it was my very first lecture. Mark Thornton got mixed up with the time and came in and pulled me off 15 minutes early.
Oh my gosh.
So you can imagine how much that screwed me up. Yeah. And so that kind of rattled me.
I would be rattled. I don't know about that decision.
I'm saying, he was just screwed up. It wasn't that he didn't like the content. I'm just saying.
There's got to be some better way to handle that.
I mean, he gave me emotion from the, and it's not like the crowd knew something happened. He didn't like literally come physically gong me, but I'm just saying that. But anyway, yeah, I can see those earlier ones where I'm very, you know, I have my notes and I'm protected by my PowerPoint and I've studied this thing beforehand and I know that this is an impregnable talk and no one, you know, and that's not what you do to give a good talk. And like you say, Tom, that advice I always tell myself before I go on for a friendly crowd and say, they came here, they know you, they want to have a good time. They will be in physical pain if you die up on stage. They do not want that to happen. So you got to just not let them think that's going to happen. So yeah, great stuff all around. Well, Tom, thank you for your generous time here. I knew when I decided I was going to do a podcast that you had to be my first guest. And I think this went very well. And so is there anything in terms of what you're working on now that you, I know you have a lot of things in play, but right now for the people who they know who you are, but now they're intrigued after hearing this conversation, what's the one thing they should go do to learn more about the world of Tom Woods?
Well, in terms of that, I would refer them to tomsfreebooks.com. I mean, you didn't think you were going to have me on and I would not be promoting my free eBooks, but
I was impressed. You got a Contra Cruise plugin as well.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I had to work for that one, but at tomsfreebooks.com, one of the books there is Bernie is Wrong, Bernie Sanders is Wrong. And that's a 150-page book. I mean, that's an actual book that I give away for free and that goes through a lot of the issues that he focuses on and just gives the response to each one of them. There are a whole bunch of free books there that you can get that will, I think, help you answer some of the harder questions that we get. Like, what about education or what about healthcare or what would you do about this or that? I've got books that answer that and they don't cost you anything. So check that out at tomsfreebooks.com. And thank you, Bob, for having me as your first guest. I'm honored to do that. Someday we'll look back on the first episode of The Bob Murphy Show, and we'll say, look at how much better it got hit. It could only go up from there.
Yeah. When I have my employee feeling all of the business coming in because I made that right move and listened to Tom. And
there.
Yeah.
There it is,
folks. I just
love
that. Okay. All right. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in, and we will see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.